warmer on Wednesday with a chance for a thunderstorm in the afternoon and high temperatures in the upper 80s. From the WCBM Weather Center, this is Tony Pan.
Talk Radio 680 WCBM. 21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus and Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner. Our engineer is Jake Bryant. You know, there is a science and art to the spiritual dimensions that is not openly taught in all sacred literature. It is veiled in symbols and archetypes from the profane. It reveals an alchemical process that mystics use to unite with the divinity found within each and every one of us. However, it can be a dangerous process, especially if one is not initiated into how to enter and leave such dimensions. Now, simplistically, let's take the symbols of three great religions, the cross, the six-pointed star, and a star and crescent. The cross of Christianity can be interpreted as vertical line, spirit, ray of light, photons. Horizontal line, the physical world, the earth's horizon, and their uniting balances these two dimensions. The six-pointed star of Judaism, uprighted triangle, fire, light, spirit, inverted triangle, water, physical world, mother of life. And when you unite these two dimensions, you also put them in balance. The Islamic star, the spiritual, light, fire, and the crescent, the material, physical, mother, lunar surface, which controls the earth's tides, they too, when you put them together, the crescent and the star, balance. From this perspective, you can interpret a truth that there are many paths to the Creator, and their symbols, or the symbols of these paths, tell a similar story. Now, if you have the eyes to see, and if you have the ears to hear, then maybe you can consider it. Mystery schools teach the science of the spiritual dimensions through such symbols and archetypes. And in recent months, we've been joined by James Wasserman and Dr. Richard Kaczynski to give us some insight into the world of Aleister Crowley. Tonight, we continue this journey with J. Daniel Gunther and his book, Initiation into the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey. In 1904, the Book of the Law declared the advent of a new period in the course of human history, the Aeon of Horus, or Aeon of the Child. The doctrine codified in the Book of Law and numerous other holy books known as Telemna revealed Aleister Crowley as the prophet of a new aeon. And in this groundbreaking book, the author J. Daniel Gunther provides a penetrating and cohesive analysis of the spiritual doctrine underlying and informing the aeon of the child and the sublime formulas of initiation encountered by those who would probe its mysteries. And drawing on more than 30 years of experiences as a student and teacher within the order of the AA, the author examines the doctrinal thread of Telemna in its historical, religious, and practical context. J. Daniel Gunther is a lifelong student of esotericism, mythology, and religion, and for over 30 years he has been a member of AA and the teaching order established by Aleister Crowley. He is considered one of the foremost authorities on the doctrines of Telemna and the syncretic method of magic and mysticism taught by the AA. He is on the editorial board of the Equinox, published by Weiser, and has served as consultant and advisor for numerous other publications in the field of occultism. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Daniel.
Hi, Bob. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Thank you, sir. Who is or was Aleister Crowley?
Well, for our point of view, Aleister Crowley, of course, was first and foremost a man. He was a great spiritual teacher, and he had a spiritual experience in Cairo, Egypt in 1904 that elevated him somewhat in certainly in our doctrine, where he became the prophet of a new message. And for us, that message is, of course, the law of Thelema, and Crowley is his prophet.
As a matter of fact, before we get into that aspect of things, dealing with his mm-hmm. prophecy, what's the meaning or definition of initiation?
Initiation, most people will think of initiation as a single event and an introduction into a mystical component. But we, in our system, view the word initiation as a beginning and setting into motion. It's not a state of being. It's a condition of going. Mm-hmm. Initiation is a mystical inward journey whereby we discover the nature and powers of our being. It's the pathway by which man becomes God.
So it's a journeying inwards?
That's correct. It's an inward journey.
And a voyage of discovery.
And a voyage of discovery of one's own soul.
Now, what is an aeon?
I've defined aeon in the book as a vast period of time that is identifiable by a clear demarcation in the change in the way we view the mystical symbols with which we interpret the mystical phenomena. In the back of my book, in fact, I put a glossary where if students who read the book can go back there and try to find a real concise definition of it. And there I say, an aeon is a vast period of time demarcated by a verifiable change in the comprehension and expression of man's relationship to the divine.
And this vast period of time is about 2,000 years or maybe 2,000?
Well, that was Crowley's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And he based his theory that the aeons last 2,000 years on zodiacal progression. As we all know, over time, the equinoctial point has changed. Now at the vernal equinox, even though we call it the first point of that is Aries, that point is actually moved now through Pisces and it's near Aquarius. That progression through the zodiac takes about 2,000 years for it to go to the next sign and so on. Crowley viewed those 2,000-year periods, each of those, as an aeon. In my book, I have expressed that is one point where I present a little bit different point of view than Crowley had. And I explain in detail that I believe, based on the work that I've done in the past, I was inspired greatly by Eric Neumann's book, The Origins and History of Consciousness, some 30 years ago, and did about a 30-year research onto this. And it's my opinion that the aeons are not limited to 2,000-year periods, that we really don't know how long each aeon really is. Because the structure and the character of the aeons is really based on archetypal symbols and the expressions of mythological motifs. If we look at Crowley's dating period, for instance, the aeon of the child started in 1904. So if you take a 2,000-year period before that, you would wind up with the aeon of the father beginning at about 100 B.C. And we would look then beyond that, we would expect to see a dominance of the great mother symbols predominant in the world. But when we look at it and examine it empirically, that is not what we find.
Mm-hmm.
We find that actually the symbolism of the father, the patriarchal period, goes much further back than that. And actually what we find is that the images of the dominance of the female, the matriarchal period, probably originated at least in prehistory, way back beyond that.
Yes, that's
so I think that Crowley was influenced not only by the zodiacal, but he was raised in a fundamental Christian home, like I was. In his lifetime, the writings of Bishop James Usher were extremely well known among fundamentalists especially, and he produced the first detailed chronology of the world based on the Bible. According to Usher, God created the world in 4004 B.C., which is strikingly close to the beginning of what Curley would have considered the age of Isis based on these 2,000-year intervals. My point with this is that Curley was raised with this dating methodology, so was I, in fact, and it's still accepted by creationists. A date of 4004 B.C. would probably not have seemed particularly odd to him. Mm-hmm. But, of course, now the scientific method, we know, of course, that the world was not created in 4004 B.C.
Well, you note that the advent of the Aeon of Horus and the reception of the Book of the Law in 1904 signified the beginning of a fundamental change mm-hmm. in the evolution of mankind.
Right.
Now, what kind of fundamental change of evolution are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about it on all levels, actually. First and foremost, where we see it spiritually, psychologically, in the way that the world begins to view itself. We see reflection of the new eon manifest in secular society as well. We anticipate that with the coming of a new eon, basically what happens is there is an upheaval of the dominant archetypes of the past. New archetypes begin to manifest. The way we look at them really begins to change. And that affects us not only spiritually, psychologically, it affects us just in our secular lives as well. I mentioned in my book, for instance, elements of things that we see that we believe are caused by the development of the new eon is the equality of the sexes. The new eon requires that there not be this imbalance, that the dominance of the patriarch over the matriarch, but rather a balance of the sexes. We see that after 1904, we begin to see the equality of the sexes, that we begin to see it in terms of sexual relationships, whether that be heterosexual, homosexual, or whatever. We begin to see the breaking of barriers on prejudice against people because of the color of their skin and so forth and so on. These are all barriers that we believe that the new eon will change because we are in this process of change. We don't expect it to take place overnight. It's going to take a long time. But we're on the way.
Yeah, we certainly are, and thank heavens for that.
Right.
Well, I don't know if we should thank heavens, but we could thank ourselves, I guess,
right.
along those lines. The Book of the Law, could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I know that our listeners, you know, with our listeners over the last 22 years, mm-hmm. we have been slowly moving in this direction of exploring. This is a particularly important area, and I am so glad to have been introduced to your book. It's a great book. It's not just a good book. It's a great book. And and I'm sure, I don't want to embarrass you, but that the key thing is that you have really clearly stated some exciting things, which we won't have enough time to get to tonight, but we can touch on a few of these. But the Book of the Law, when people hear such things as the Book of the Law, what are we referring to here? What is the Book of the Law?
The Book of the Law is a very short book of three chapters that was dictated to Aleister Crowley in 1904 on over 3 days. The first chapter was on April 8th, 1904. The second chapter on April 9th. Third chapter on April 10th. Took approximately 1 hour for the dictation. According to Crowley's account, he had an encounter with a praetor human intelligence by the name of Iwas, who appeared to him at exactly noon on the first day and dictated this chapter out loud verbally, and he wrote it down. The next day, the same thing happened with the second chapter. The third day, the third chapter. In the Book of the Law, the book claims to be basically a landmark book that lays out the progress of humankind for this next period that is codified in these three chapters. Crowley himself had a very difficult time, accepting the Book of the Law as, you know, for being what it was. He fought it, frankly, for a number of years before he did come around to accept it. And basically, the Book of the Law is our most sacred book. We've guarded very carefully with the, the admonition, for instance, that we are not to change the book even so much as the style of a letter. We don't change an uppercase letter to a lowercase. We were very, very careful about that because we don't want to see what's happened to all the other religious texts over the centuries happen to our holy books. There are no holy books that we know of that haven't been changed over the years. The variants of all of them exist. Some of them are extreme variants, and that's because of human manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But in a nutshell, that's really what the Book of the Law is. It is the core and basis of the doctrine of Thelema. It introduced the law of Thelema to the world, and it outlines for each individual what is required to live the life of a Thelemite, to follow the law of Thelema. We do not dictate to any person the meaning of the law. And that is for each person to decide on their own by reading the book, by comparison with Crowley's own words on it. But it's a holy book that we do not dictate to anyone what it means. It's up to the individual to decide for themselves the meaning of that book in their own life.
Now, when we come to the Gnostic philosophy, could you give us a brief interpretation of that before we get into what Carl Jung...
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
Gnostic philosophy. Could you give us a brief interpretation of what Gnosticism might be?
Well, Gnosticism historically has... It's one of those things, the word means a knower.
A knower.
Gnosis. But, of course, Gnosticism itself, as a religious movement, had a variety of sects, very much like the early Christianity had a variety of sects. In fact, the Gnostics considered themselves Christians. The Christians that won the struggle, if you will, did not consider the Gnostics Christians. But basically, their philosophies... There was a parallel that ran through them all, and that was that I believe that the understanding of spirituality was more of an internal rather than an external point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads us to the point that I really wanted to get to, because this is where I think your work is pretty extraordinary. Carl Jung, in his Psychology and Alchemy, noted that Gnosticism had to grow up at a time when the classical religions had become obsolete. Now, how have the classical religions become obsolete?
Well, because what happens is that all religions are ultimately based on the experience of archetypes, the archetypal symbols that rise from the collective unconscious. They manifest as dominance in the world. They take on a numinous quality and a numinous character. It is our interaction with the archetypes that allows us to grow spiritually. And as these, over time, some of these dominants lose their numinosity. They fail to function to work the mystical participation. And that's exactly what happened, that allowed the rise of Christianity in the first place, or Gnosticism particularly. It's somewhat reflected in the old call that we read about, Pan is dead.
Mm-hmm.
The pagan gods, the numinosity of those images had become deflated. They no longer really functioned at the spiritual level. And when that happens, what occurs is it creates a void in the psyche of humans. And when there is such a void, new archetypes move to the forefront. They come out and manifest themselves, and of course, that's what happened at the beginning of Christianity among the Gnostics, and of course, in the figure of Jesus, is also an archetype of the Christ, which is a very, very old one. We find it in a variety of cultures in a variety of places, with certain similar characteristics.
And we're going to take our first break, friends, and our guest is Daniel J. Gunther, Initiation into the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey, IBIS, IBIS Press. Now, click the link to order it on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or call 1-800-423-7087.
WCBM.
If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at theSellingWell.com. That's theSellingWell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit theSellingWell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890. TheSellingWell.com. What are the seven things you should know before trying holistic health care? Find out at the Ruska Mansion's Basics of Self-Healing on Sunday, September the 13th, from 1 to 4 p.m. On the web at Ruscom, RUSCOMBE.org, Ruscom.org, or call 410-367-7300. The Ruscom Mansion is the oldest and largest wellness center on the East Coast and is home to 30 licensed practitioners of acupuncture, massage, herbal and nutritional counseling, energy healing, homeopathy, and more. Meet them in person at the 25th anniversary open house on the 13th of September, 1 to 4 p.m. Call 410-367-7300. Healthy meals, activities for kids, yoga by the lily pond, and herbal tastings at the Ruscom Mansion. 410-367-7300, September the 13th, free event. Learn the seven tips to find the best natural therapy for you. 410-367-7300.
Hello, this is Dr. William Rohl. I'm a parapsychologist and the author of a book, Unleashed, of Poltergeist and Murder, The Curious Story of Tina Resch. And I'm very appreciative, Dr. Bob, for telling people about parapsychological occurrences.
Thank you, Dr. Bill. This is, of course, 21st Century Radio with our guest, Daniel Gunther. Initiation into the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey, IBIS, I-B-I-S Press. Click the link to order it on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or call 1-800-423-7087. Well, Daniel, both you and Crowley were brought up in Christian fundamentalist homes. Why do you believe that fundamental Christianity harbors a hatred for true science?
Well, we can only go by the witness of history. We can look back into the past and we can see all the great scientists who were jailed or burned at the stake or terrorized by the church when their ideas that they presented, when their scientific ideas ran cross-grain to the doctrine that was accepted at that time. Mm-hmm. And although the ferocity of their disapproval, if you will, we don't hear people typically being burned at the stake anymore, that has toned down somewhat, but their verbal assault against the scientific method is still very much out there. We still see the battle, if you will, between creationism and the science of evolution and so forth. I mean, those are just one example. They have always had a very hostile attitude toward these new ideas, the scientific idea, because it obviously threatens their foundation. They want to be the sole authority, and unlike the Dalai Lama, I think you had a very sound view of religion and science. I'm going to paraphrase him, but basically he said, if science disproves your religious viewpoint, then obviously your religious viewpoint is incorrect in some way. You need to go back and reevaluate it if science disproves it. However, in Christianity, that has never been the attitude. The attitude has always been that the church view is always right, mm-hmm. to the detriment of anything else.
Well, those past 8 years have shown us exactly what that does. Into the destruction of, well, we're looking at a culture whose climate is obviously changing, but to refuse to look at it for the past 8 years, we put ourselves and our entire planet in jeopardy, great jeopardy. What is the formula No, before we get to the formula for the dying God, which is you do so well, you really do that well. But let's return to a brief explanation of what thelemna means.
Okay. Well, the word thelema is Greek. It means will. Now, in plain language, will is essentially our true nature. So, as I greeted you when we came on the radio, I said, "Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law." We don't mean do what you want to do. We say that every man and every woman is a star. And that is, we are each a unique individual in the body of heaven, and we each have a true course to follow. And that is the effortless pathway free of restriction. The discovery of our true will is essentially the unveiling of that nature, the true course of the star. Would you like me to elaborate a bit on that?
The star? That is really... You've done a hell of a job on that, and but before we get to that, must the reader adopt or accept this law of thelemna to gain value from your book?
No. It's an interesting question, one I've certainly thought over a number of times. I suppose I would have to admit that a person who has decided to actively follow the law of thelemma would gain some value at a different level than somebody who does not. However, I would also like to think there's a value that can be gained from the book even if one does not accept the law of thelemma. Or many of the things, for instance, I've written about religion and philosophy are potential areas of value for someone not committed to our particular viewpoint. So the answer to your question is no, you do not need to accept the law of thelemma to get value from the book.
Now let's return to the star, because at a critical point you say in the doctrine of thelemma is the understanding that every man and woman is a star. What is meant by that?
Well, the theory behind this is that every man and every woman has unique attributes that, when they're considered in relation to the environment, they indicate that each of us, like a celestial body, has a natural and proper course of action. Like a celestial body, each of them have their own magnitude, their own characteristics, their direction, and so on. In the perfect relationship to their environment, that creates a beautiful harmony that's observable when each body essentially minds its own business, if you will, and they follow its natural course. We can observe what happens, from the Earth when a celestial body deviates from that course, or due to external interference from another celestial body or an internal failure. There's disruption of the original harmony, or even complete destruction of the bodies involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true of human beings who are capable of following their true will. They function without interference, following the pathway of their nature without causing pain and discomfort to others. The following of true will, for instance, it doesn't necessarily have to be easy, and it may not always be enjoyable. Let me make a personal observation. Like, for instance, I would be willing to bet that it was your true will to get your PhD. Would that be a pretty good guess?
Indeed, yes, yes.
And to realize that affirmation of your will, there's probably a 50-50 chance that you had to take some classes that were less interesting than others, and some you may have been just excruciating to sit through if your time in college was anything like mine.
You must be reading my mind, of course.
But the point being here is that it was part of the requirement for the degree, and therefore it was part of the journey you had to take to realize that true will. So when we weigh those things into the mix in the long term, following our true will doesn't mean that it's always going to be easy, it's always going to be nice and pleasant, but it may be required for us to reach the end of our goal to achieve this thing or that thing or the other thing. As far as the symbolism of the stars, of course, it's an archetypal symbol. Interestingly enough, if we look at it scientifically, of course, all of us physically are really star stuff. We were made when that Big Bang occurred and all of that material was blown out to create the universe. All of us in our bodies, all human beings, are really created from star stuff. So there is an actual physical parallel to that, which I find to be really quite beautiful, but not required necessarily for the interpretation of that symbol.
I've often wondered what John Lennon knew in regards to that particular area when he made statements that we're all stars. and other rock folks that rock and rollers that I spent some time with were all the same mind and had high, and I know he had high regard for Crowley.
Is that right?
Yes, he did. And the now, we need to go back to this dying God because but before I was going to go into the ministry, and several things altered that course, one being my studying the Dead Sea Scrolls, which certainly changed me a great deal, and it's unfortunate that still we haven't gotten to the bottom of that one. The other dealt with, I doing my research, I found out there was a whole series of dying gods, and I wanted to understand what that meant. And you review this area. What's the formula for the dying god, and which cultures can be can it be found?
Well, one of the basic, well, let's go back to, like you were saying, what is the basic thing? The formula of the dying god is that, you know, we can look historically, like you said, we can see it in the legends of Odin, Dionysus, Adonis, Attis, Osiris, Jesus. They all contain elements of that central motif, and basically what it relates to is a figure that undergoes passion or undergoes suffering, is destroyed, and then is resurrected into life again. And they all seem to carry this basic thing. They suffer the loss of life as all mortal men do, but they rise from the dead. This was, by looking at the evidence, it seems clear to us that at the beginning of the Aeon of the Father, these motifs begin to manifest from the collective unconscious. And these usurp the dominance of the matriarchal reign at that time. And it came in the form of this man, or man-god, who basically conquered the one thing that man feared more than anything, which is death. And like I said, they suffer death as all mortal men, but they have the one thing that mortal men do not have, the ability to rise from the dead. And that's basically the whole doctrine in a nutshell. We see it, a very old, well-developed example of it, of course, is in Egypt with the god Osiris, who was the beloved god, husband of Isis, and through the treachery of the god Set is slain. And through the assistance of Isis, Osiris is resurrected from the dead and comes to life again. And Osiris was the foremost god in Egypt from a very, very long time back.
You, do you remember the book 16 Crucified Saviors?
I do.
That's the book that really knocked me out. I mean, I carried it and showed it to bishops. I showed it to other clergymen, etc. Of course, they were not happy about my showing it to them. But that's the reason why I kept asking them the questions. What is the patterning? I said, this seems like a pattern here. Mm-hmm. Don't you see any pattern in this? And, of course, they didn't necessarily think that I was good ministerial material, asking those kind of questions. And I guess I really wasn't, because I really wanted to find out what was going on there. The
that book was written by Kersey Graves, right?
Yes, thank you. And I always thought it was, I kept forgetting his first name, and I thought it was a different Graves, the White Goddess Graves. But I can't even call his first name anymore. Robert Graves. That's what it is. Oh, and that one's a real knockout, too. What do you mean? Oh, did we take a break? Yes, let's take the break. And when we come back, we can ask you to study up on this question so you can pass this test, okay? We're gonna ask you about what do you mean when you say Christianity is ultimately built upon the archetype of fear of the dark? When we return with Daniel Gunther, Initiation into the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey, Ibis Press, and we're going to go into a quiz here, and you'll get a chance to win it. You can click the link to order it on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or call 1-800-423-7087.
If If you
on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
What is the Woodstock vision? Why do so many people see this event as generation-defining? Plus, a visit with the sister of Jimi Hendrix on his electrifying performance at Woodstock. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Zoe Hieronymus here. Visit my website, www.zoharaonline.com. That's Zohara, Z-O-H-A-R-A, online.com. Find podcasts of decades of radio interviews, journalism, and photography. Find links to experts worldwide and in Maryland for subjects that range from where to sail in Maryland to the latest in UFOs. Find out about artificial intelligence and spiritual pathways. Zohara Online is a hub for finding books, people, and organizations in the business of doing good. It's always an adventure without reservations. Visit my website, www.zoharaonline.com.
Well, let me remind you, Ziggy Marley returns to 21st Century Radio on August the 16th, and, you know, you just heard from Queen Zohara there, and Queen Zohara, I think Ziggy Marley read every page of her book dealing with the feminine... side of prophecy. We'll be back with her later on. However, would you like to win a free copy of the book that we're talking about this hour? It's called Initiation in the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey by Daniel Gunther, courtesy of Ibis Books, 1-800-423-7087. If you know the answer to this hour's question, this trivia question, you will win that book, plus at least a dozen other books and periodicals. Here's the question. Do you know the name of our first hour guest last week on 21st Century Radio? All you got to do, if you know the name of our 21st Century Radio guest last week, hour one, you need to qualify by doing this. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hi, this is Stephen Schwartz, and it's a pleasure to be here tonight talking with Bob Hieronymus on one of the most exciting radio programs that I know in the country. 21st Century Radio is really a place where you will get good information from things that matter in your life and that will give you an insight into who you are and why you're here.
Well, thank you, Uncle Stephen. And, of course, our guest is Daniel Gunther, Initiation in the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey, Ibis Press. 1-800-423-7087 is the number to call. Oh, gosh, I have too many questions, and we're not going to get to most of them. But I'll give a couple more a try. What do you mean when you say Christianity is ultimately built on the archetype on the archetypal, that is, fear of the dark?
Well, we look by what do I mean by archetypal fear of the dark? When man evolved, basically, we, at one point, prior to reaching full consciousness, we dwelled in the unconscious. Eventually, we, as consciousness began to develop, unconsciousness became identified with darkness. Consciousness became identified with the waking time, being awareness, light. And in the early ages of man in our development, nighttime was, of course, the greatest danger of predators. Night was the enemy of light, vision, warmth, safety, security. Daytime, of course, obviously they could see better. And so there is an archetypal component here that evolved with us, and this is a very natural thing. We still see it in young children. Even in a well-nurtured home, for instance, a young child who lives in a balanced home can experience fear of the dark. It's kind of an atavistic resurgence. It's irrational. So there is this split in our psyche where we think in terms of the darkness is bad, the light is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Christianity prospered on that because all of its symbols that it promises security with are symbols of the light. For instance, they believers are promised an eternal paradise where it never grows dark. And that's in the book of Revelation. The Apostle Paul wrote to the Christians in Colossus that we would be saints in light and delivered from the powers of darkness. And all of these terminologies are fairly consistent. And then, of course, then they speak of the outer darkness or hell, which is the death of the soul. And the fear, the natural instinctive fear that human beings have, they have really, in my point of view, they played up on that. The greatest fear that we have, the greatest darkness that we fear, is, of course, the darkness of death. And their doctrine basically says, without belief in them, in this doctrine, we have no hope to get past that being lost in that great darkness, lost in that great unknown. Basically, our soul will be damned to hell for eternity if we don't follow that. And this is basically an instinctive fear of the dark that causes human beings to fear that.
Well, it certainly does, and I think it's unfortunate. Of course, Carl Jung obviously examined that area very carefully. Now, you note that one of the great revelations to the Egyptian initiates was that Osiris is a black god. Mm-hmm. Now, what is meant by this? Because in my discussions with many African Americans, they're thinking of this sentence, this idea, mm-hmm. in one way and one way only.
Right.
But I think you bring up some really important points up on page 37 here. What does it really mean? Why is it important that Osiris is a black god? What is meant by that?
Well, I use that because the phrase does occur in one of our holy books. So that's one of the reasons I bring it to the fore. But no, it does not have any relationship to the color of skin. It has to do with the fact that the word means the black land, Kemet. If we look historically at Egypt, the rich black soils deposited by the River Nile with each yearly flood, and it turns the parched desert into a fertile arable land. And for the Egyptians, this was the complete difference between harvest or famine. It was the gift of life instead of death. Mm-hmm. And this mystical statement, Osiris is a black god, it says a couple of things. Number one, Osiris, of course, was Egypt. Every person in Egypt, upon their death, they called themselves Osiris. They identified totally with it. And it has to do with the fact that if we are as spiritual beings, if we are to walk in the light, we must first walk in darkness. We have to look inside ourselves first off and see that which we truly are.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same symbolism that the alchemist spoke of when we talk about turning the worthless lead into gold. First, we've got to examine the lead. We've got to walk in darkness and see who we are before we can discover the light. The seed of that lies dormant in the fields of night.
Well, you have received some really outstanding reviews of this book. In fact, it's been said that this is the most important work of its type since Crowley himself. Did you expect that?
No, I really didn't. I really didn't give it a whole lot of thought either. When I was writing the book, my true focus was to write the book that I really needed to write, the book that I was expected to write. I knew there was nothing exactly like it out there like it except what Crowley had written. And I did submit the book to peer review. It's our policy with works like this. It's part of the scientific method that we embrace. Yeah. But, of course, the feedback I received from those would be what you would expect from professional peers. They were informative and passionless remarks and constructive criticism. I didn't really hear any of that until the book was published. Frankly, Bob, I've been very humbled by some of the kind things that some people have said, and I'm really, really happy that people tell me that the book has helped them. That is my sole purpose in writing the book.
It's obvious to me, because I learned a great deal. I just love to learn, and especially from the perspective of Well, let's get to something that's real, real important to me, and I think every other human being, the dark night of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us have heard that phrase over and over again, but
right.
what is the dark night of the soul?
Well, the dark night of the soul is basically a period just pretty much like it sounds. It's that when I don't know of anyone really who hasn't started out on the path of initiation who eventually, sooner or later, encounters this period called the dark night of the soul. And basically, I think it's caused from where we're confronting all the negative aspects of our personality. We see things in a realistic light. It can be brought on, it brings on depression, if you will, because when we truly look at ourselves, if we look at ourselves in the mirror, we see that compared to the divine, we're a long way from that. We've got a long way to go.
Sure do.
And basically, it's a period of dryness that most of us pass through at some point, where it seems like we've lost the golden thread. And basically, the only way through that period of darkness, depression, a sense of loss, you know, I've lost the golden thread, what am I doing, what's the point, is to persevere. And we persevere without lust for result, and eventually that darkness will lift, and we will see that it was a necessary phase for us to pass through, because it truly is a purgative of the soul.
Well, I wish I would have known that about 38 years ago. Why weren't you? You were around 38 years ago.
I was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know.
But I was a little younger.
It is amazing how, you know, when most of us who do work with various esoteric societies, you know, we all have these images in our head as to how we're going to be doing the great work, and
right.
And then we find out that we better make sure that we can afford our next pair of shoes. Or, you know, I mean, it gets down to some real practicalities, and we think to ourselves, hey, what is this? I mean, you know, if I'm going off into the spiritual dimension here, what do I need all this physical stuff? But you really need to balance and keep your feet in both parts of the world. And of course, you mentioned something about the mirror in your last answer. The magic mirror. What is the magic mirror in this type of work?
Well, the magic mirror is a symbolic magical weapon that is in the arsenal of the magician, but what it truly boils down to is the ability to look at yourself truly. And that's why we say, and we call it a magic mirror as opposed to a regular one. It's the ability to examine yourself constructively without prejudice and be able to recognize the fact, you know, recognize yourself warts and all, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that you really don't lose your perspective. You know, there's a tendency with all spiritual work for the ego to become inflated. And if we don't look into that mirror, then we have a false image of who we are. And, of course, there's a whole variety of myths that circle around the magic mirror. The important thing is that we learn to examine ourselves and distinguish between the illusory and the genuine components of who we are.
Well, I understand you're making personal appearances, giving lectures now. I see that you're going to be in New York this coming weekend. Can you give us some details on that particular event?
Oh, I sure can. I'll be, on July the 25th, I'll be at a lecture and book signing. It's going to be at 22 East 30th Street, beginning at 6 p.m., There will be a book signing after the lecture. The lecture is going to be about an hour. And the event's being sponsored by the Tahuti Lodge of the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis in New York. And all the details on this are listed at tahutilodge.org. And it's TAHUTILODGE.org. And, I recently did a lecture and book signing in Portland. People up there, the OTO Lodge in Portland, hosted the event. They were very gracious to me. And in the upcoming weeks, I'll be doing some more events like that.
Well, that really must feel, you must feel some fulfillment here.
Well, I do.
The
greatest fulfillment I have is being able to interact with people who are able to give me feedback and say, you know, this helps me. And that's very fulfilling when you know that your work is being able to help people. As I said, you know, a few minutes ago, my sole reason for writing the book was to try to help people. And it is very fulfilling when you hear that they feel that you are helping them.
Well, you certainly helped me a great deal, and I greatly appreciate that, Daniel.
Thank you.
Daniel Gunther, Initiation in the Aeon of the Child, The Inward Journey, Ibis Press. You can click the link to order it on our front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or call 1-800-423-7087, 1-800-423-7087. Thank you for joining us, Daniel.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Pleasure was all ours. And when we return, yes, indeed, it's back to Negro League Baseball and Bob Luke and the Baltimore Alight Giants when we return.
Names and talk on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore.
From ABC News.